From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. Visit them on the web at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hello, and welcome to episode 59 of Connecting with Walt. I am your host and Diz historian, Michael Bowling. I am joined by my co-host, producer, and good friend, Craig Williams. Bonjour, Craig.
Et bonjour, Michael.
You say it so much better. I guess you should have said Michelle. I don't know. But, and of course, we're Tish. That's French. Of course, we're speaking that way because you were in a whole different kingdom the last few days, weren't you?
I absolutely was. Yeah, I was given the amazing opportunity by Disney to go on a fully paid for trip to Disneyland Paris, and. Well, I guess I should say that with an asterisk. It wasn't completely fully paid. It was fully paid for the flight, the hotel, and a couple meals, plus the park access and the Disney Fan Days event, which is the whole reason I was out there. But the one quick service meal I ate in the park when I actually stopped to eat something, because looking back on it, I only ate, I think, four meals the entire time I was there, including breakfast, lunch, and dinner, just because I was so busy. The one quick service meal in the parks I ate myself, I did pay for that. So I feel strongly that I could review that one, because I know that the $22 that came out of my pocket for a piece of Parisian pizza and a beer and a bottle of water. But yeah, it was a great trip that Disney sent me on, and it was definitely a whirlwind, and I cannot wait to share it with everyone very soon on our show.
Mm-hmm. That's right. If all goes as planned, Craig is going to share a couple of his trips with us next week.
Yeah, obviously the Disneyland Paris trip being slightly more interesting than the other one, but...
I don't know. But I know you'll talk about your connections with Walt on both. About both those trips.
Absolutely, so. Yeah.
I had a Disney culinary moment this past week as well.
Oh, yeah?
There's a place in Sacramento called the Napoli Culinary Academy and Cafe Napoli. And it's a culinary institute. So they, of course, train students in the restaurant and hospitality industry. And one of the things they do is that they also have cooking classes that their chefs lead and that their students sort of help facilitate. And some of them are, like Carol and I took one a while back, and it was an Italian cooking class, and these are a lot of fun. And in that one we learned like how to make chicken marsala and minestrone soup and cannolis. But they have a series of Disney themed cooking classes, and I went to one with a friend because Carol and I were supposed to go, and Carol wasn't that interested in the menu, and she was only going to go because I wanted to go, and then because she's still recovering from surgery, she couldn't go, and we had canceled this like three times, so she didn't want to cancel it again. So I went with a friend of ours, and it was a Mary Poppins themed.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, cooking class. So, and what they do is you go in and, you know, you get a free beverage of your choice, either alcoholic or soft. And then they start watching. You have a sort of a little social hour kind of, or 30 minutes. And then they start playing Mary Poppins. And then they pause it for a bit, and then the demonstration chef, and she's an executive. She'd been a student there. She was an executive chef at another restaurant in Sacramento. I found out in talking with her afterwards, she had worked at the Magic Kingdom in and at Disney Hollywood Studios. She was, or it was Disney MGM Studios at the time. She was a friend of Mickey, friend of Minnie. She was a friend of Chip and Dale. She was a friend of Chip in the Beauty and the Beast show over at the Disney MGM Studios. She was a friend of a number of other characters, and she was in some of the parades, and she showed me photos.
That's
that she
cool.
still had of herself on her phone. I thought, wow, talk about a small world.
Yeah, what are the odds?
Really, but we learned how to make London fog soup, which is basically like a split pea and ham soup. And so what they do first is they demonstrate it for you, how to make it, and they talk you sort of through it. And it's very much like in Ratatouille. Anyone can cook. How you're the chef, you cook it to your taste, and anybody that tries to tell you how to cook, you tell them to get out of your kitchen. and then they'll have someone come up and help, and they had me taste a little because they asked, is anybody British or British background who's familiar with these dishes? And I raised my hand, so I became like the taster. In this. And then it was supposed to be shepherd's pie, but it was actually cottage pie. But most Americans think of this as shepherd's pie. But it was made with ground beef and vegetables, and shepherd's pie of course is lamb without vegetables. But I really like this. So we learned how to do that. And then the dessert, it wasn't really a dessert, and this is something that doesn't go with the cottage pie, but it was how to make Yorkshire pudding. Which is what sort of attracted me to it all. And then what they do is after you go through all that, then they break you up into groups, and then groups of three, and different groups make different parts of the meal, and then they add to it. One of the students will make a vegetable or something like that, or a salad to go with it, and then you sit down, and then they finish the film, and then they serve you what you've prepared. Mm-hmm. And it was great fun. And then one of the pastry students came out and brought out these Napoleons that she had just made. These things were enormous. I mean, two people could eat these and be full. Could eat one and be full. And they were only $4 each. And and the money goes to their scholarship fund. Anyway, we had so much fun. And they have a Little Mermaid-themed one where you learn seafood. They have an Aladdin-themed one where you learn Moroccan food. Anyway, they have all kinds of different ones. There's a Lilo and Stitch one. There's all these Disney-themed ones. So
yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, so it was a lot of fun. And so I definitely want to do this again. And these things sell out within 24 hours. So I don't know, maybe if I sign up for another one. If those of you who live in the Sacramento area and you follow us on Connecting Walt, if I sign up for one of these, I will post it. And maybe if you want to sign, first of all, these are very reasonably priced, these courses. And go on Groupon. You can usually find a Groupon. Coupon for them. Mm-hmm. And then they give you a code after your first class so that you still get the same Groupon price when you register for the class through them for any future classes. And all the money goes, again, to their scholarship fund. And maybe a few Connecting with Walt listeners, maybe we can, go to one of these together and, do a Disney cooking class. It might be fun. So.
Oh yeah, I'm jealous.
Anyway, yeah, it's great. It's just one of those things, and it was terrific because I got to talk to a lot of Disney fans, some young Disney fans, and all that. Because this is definitely a family experience.
Yeah,
to do this.
That sounds so nice.
Well, today, Craig and I are delighted to welcome Jeff Curdy to Connecting with Walt. Jeff is one of the leading authorities on the Walt Disney Company, its founder, and its history. Jeff is the author of more than 25 books, and he worked for Walt Disney Imagineering, the theme park design division of the Walt Disney Company, and then for the corporate special projects department of Disney. And he did a whole lot even more than that. Since 1995, Jeff has enjoyed a career as an author, a writer, a consultant in the motion picture, theater, and theme park entertainment industries. More recently, he was the creative director, content consultant, and media producer for the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco. And he's a producer of that incredible documentary, The Boys, the Sherman Brothers story. And he's the author of a new book, Travels with Walt Disney, A Photographic Voyage Around the World. Listeners to both our old Disneyland show and Connecting with Walt know that I frequently reference Jeff's books. And most likely a majority of you out there have several of Jeff's books in your personal library. And we're delighted to have Jeff on the show. Jeff, welcome to Connecting with Walt.
Well, hello, and thank you for asking me, and it's fun to be here. I'm glad you asked.
Oh, we are too. You know, we were talking before the show, and, you know, my wife and I first met you and your family around 10 years ago when you were a featured speaker on the Disney Magic on a Panama Canal cruise.
And I love the Disney cruises, and I think we've done the Panama Canal now, I want to say, 3 times.
Oh, wow.
So I get asked on those long cruises because they have so many sea days. And they need people who can get up and lie convincingly about Disney history. But basically, they like to fill in time for the Disney fans on the cruise with different presentations and information about Disney history. So that's been kind of my great joy, is going on the Disney cruises. And then, of course, I get to meet people like you. And I've made a lot of friends over the years just that I've met on cruises who live all over the world. It's been pretty special. I owe a lot to Walt.
Yeah. Well, it was through you I first learned about the Walt Disney Family Museum, because you talked about what you were working on. And you had this incredible concept art for it there. And you talked about a wonderful book you had done, really a great introduction to the theater and how it works, and even how to attend the theater. It's a marvelous book, a very unique book.
How Does the Show Go On? How Does the Show Go On? Had 2 editions back then, and I'm actually working on a new updated and revised edition with Tom Schumacher, the producer and president of Disney Theatrical. We're doing an updated version that will include Frozen and Newsies and Aladdin, and all up to date 10 years later on. So I think that's going to come out, well, it's going to be within the next 8 months or 9 months, I think.
Oh, just excellent.
Going into design right now.
Oh, so good. Well,
yeah,
I will get that. That was a really good one.
It is really good, and it's sort of timeless, too. And it's really, it's interesting because it's really intended audiences to sort of introduce children to the theater. But I'm actually very surprised at how many adults have said, gee, I learned so much that I never knew before, because they didn't come from a theater background or hadn't done theater in school or anything. So it really is just sort of a marvelous, real, all ages kind of book.
I agree. Absolutely. Now on this show, Craig and I have commented on how amazing it is that young Walt Disney, who grew up working through much of his youth, had almost no toys, had little exposure to the world beyond his communities, and yet grew up to have unlimited imagination and vision. And in your new book, Travels with Walt Disney, A Photographic Voyage Around the World, you chronicle how Walt was also a seasoned international traveler when many of his generation and background didn't venture far from their hometown or state. And
it's so true.
And what do you believe was the spark within Walt that propelled his desire to discover the world and its people?
Boy, so much within Walt. I've studied Walt for decades, and so much. I just think he had a ceaselessly curious and questing mind. And I keep thinking about, you know, those formative early years. I just got back from Marceline. I'd never been to Marceline, Missouri before, and I spent a day there on the 25th of May with the D23 group. And I realized there's something that's particularly enchanting about a small Midwestern town. I understand why he never shook off his Midwestern roots But I can also see, just by the location of Marceline and the formative years when he lived there, the trains go by constantly. And when Marceline had a working Santa Fe station, there must have been something about seeing the trains come in and all the sort of the strangers coming from faraway places. And the idea that you could get on there and go, think about it at the time too, you could go anywhere on the train within the continental United States, at least, and you could then go forth from there. So I think this sort of yearn, I have this romantic vision of young Walt sitting, listening to the train whistles and dreaming about what was at the other end of the tracks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting. Yeah, and of course that was, for our younger listeners, they may not know that steam locomotives were the primary mode of long-distance transportation within the United States, you know, when Walt was a boy and a young man. And what I really enjoyed about your book, one of the things is you explain how in many ways sort of Walt was transported to his destiny on board trains. You know, like traveling to California in 1923, you know, creating Mickey Mouse on a train, you know, from New York to Los Angeles. And there's something you talked about that I hadn't read too much about, and that was the 1931 Gypsy Jaunt. And can you tell listeners a little about what that was? Because I found it entertaining.
Absolutely. and to your previous point, you know, the context is everything in studying Walt.
Mm-hmm.
And when you consider that Walt, he remembered that when he was a boy in Marceline, for instance, there were 8 automobiles. The Wright brothers had only recently flown in Kitty Hawk. So the train was the way. The train was the modern transportation. The train was everything. Mm-hmm. I think it set ideas about progress in his mind and all sorts of ideas about being interested in technology. So the train, you can't underestimate the value of the train. And of course, being a Midwest boy, he was brought up with the legends of, you know, the great mighty Mississippi and Mark Twain and Life on the Mississippi and Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. So in the early 30s, about 1931, he was having a lot of difficulty coping with success. And he basically had what he called a hell of a breakdown. And the doctors simply advised him to get away from all things that had to do with work. The context, once again, let's remember, Walt got really famous, really successful, really fast. And this was a guy who really liked to work. So it all overwhelmed him. So he and Lily went away on what Lily dubbed the Gypsy Jaunt, as you had said earlier. Mm-hmm. And his intent was to take the train out to Kansas City and environs and go to St. Louis and take a riverboat down the Mississippi. He had this romantic Midwestern notion about the riverboat. Well, they got there and found that there was no more passenger riverboat on the Mississippi. It was all commerce and freight, and the glamorous sort of movie idea of the steamboat didn't exist anymore. So they continued their travels and wound up in Key West, Florida. And at that point decided that they were going to go to Cuba. So they really did take the Gypsy Jaunt somewhat literally. They let the road take them where they would. They moved really without too much plan and spent their time resting, enjoying the scenery, relaxing along the way. So it really was transformative for him. And I think like a lot of people, young people who get into, you know, career paths and so on, you have to learn to balance your work with your leisure and to give yourself the time to rest. And I think that was really a pleasurable learning experience for Walt and for Lily. I think a lot of times. I'd be really interested I wanted to talk to the grandkids a little bit more about their granny and find out just more about her. I find more and more that she's in anecdotes about Walt, but we never really get a fully rounded portrait of how important Lily was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Lily tempered Walt's genius and nailed it down to the ground. I keep thinking of Fred McMurray and Greer Garson in The Happiest Millionaire.
Yes.
And I sort of think Walt was a lot like Anthony Drexel Biddle, thumping around and bellowing and having live alligators live in the house. And then there was Lily, sort of the Greer Garson figure, saying, yes, Walt, dear, yes, patting his hand and making him sort of come back down to earth. I think that relationship is really sort of richly felt when you read about and look at the travels that they did together, including that very important 1931 trip across the country into Cuba.
Yeah, I've gotten the impression she was very much a sounding board for Walt and gave him a lot of feedback to his ideas. That
what's interesting is she doesn't seem to have been terribly, I don't know how to put this, she doesn't seem to have been terribly interested in, or passionate about the things he was, but she understood them, and they understood how important they were to him, and thus, exactly as you said, could offer support, guidance, and a perspective that I think only comes from being outside of the passion
mm-hmm.
to a large degree. So I just, it's such an interesting and very seldom discussed relationship. And I think it was, you know, ultimately quite mutually beneficial on many levels. And I think that in many ways, Lily is sort of an unsung hero in that. She's often relegated to this sort of role as the wife and mother. And I think she was much, much more than that.
I agree. I think she would have to be married to Walt. I don't know. Absolutely. I just always, yeah. So, but now you mentioned that, there's the first time that Walt really saw the world. And, you know, and of course that was during World War One. And I when I was reading, you know, and looking at the photos of what you had in your book of that time in Walt's life when he was volunteered in the Red Cross, and I thought of that that song that was popular in World War One. How are you going to keep him down on the farm after they've seen the Paris? Yeah,
exactly.
And I thought that applied to Walt because I thought
absolutely. You know, and the critical maturation, the baptism by fire, the going from the boy to the man, it's all so corny. Like so much of Walt's life story is so what we would call corny. But that's what you did. A lot of Midwestern farm boys went off to war, went off to serve, went off to, you know, Walt went off to the Red Cross. The war had ended and he, you know, sort of thought he had missed it all. But once again, he wound up having experiences and growth and a maturation. And I think it was either he or Roy who said that a boy went away and a man came back. Not that anything was traumatizing that happened to him, but I think he learned how the world worked to a larger degree when he went away to join the Red Cross. And it really prepared him for a lot of things that he would encounter in his life, whether it was eccentric or difficult personalities or situations that you feel you failed or that you're trapped. And also the fearlessness I think one gets from travel. I think that the more you travel, the less you fear others,
mm-hmm.
the less that you have trepidation about the foreign, whether that's a different place, an exotic location. Those can be intimidating, very scary ideas. And I only speak from personal experience because I'm an idiot who never got his passport until age of 32. I never went anywhere because, to be honest, I'll be honest because it's just you and me, right?
And a few of our closest friends.
I was afraid to travel. What if? What if this happens? What if that happened? I spent so much time what-ifing that I missed a lot of great experiences I could have had in my 20s. So I think that Walt benefited on so many levels from his Red Cross experience. Things that resonated, they do with Walt. There's that famous Jesuit motto about show me the boy and I'll show you the man, basically, mm-hmm. is what it says. And that describes Walt, I think, in so many ways, from his experiences in Marceline and his experience in the Red Cross and then in Kansas City. I just think so much happened that was informing and influential to him before he was even 20 years old, and things that echoed and resonated and rippled through his entire lifetime. And really, once again, to all of our benefit in that sense.
I agree. Yeah, and he made lifetime friends too out of that.
So. Oh, absolutely. And that was another thing that was very interesting. Friends from, you know, people that he continued to be interested in and call on, and people who came out and, you know, like Walt Pfeiffer, who worked at the studio for his whole life, had been a boyhood pal of Walt's. Walt would travel back and forth, once again, by train in the 30s and 40s, and he would stop off and visit in Kansas City and catch up with old friends that were lifetime friends.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of other important railroad trips. His trip with Ward Kimball to the Chicago Railroad Fair. I think that was yet another turning point, I think, in Walt's life. Especially creativity.
Because once again, he had gotten to a point where he was being advised medically to get the heck out of town. Mm-hmm. You know, he had gone through all of the crises of the war, and he was busy, as he often did with himself and with his work, he was busy sort of reinventing what Disney was. And his nurse, Hazel George, and his doctor basically said, time for vacation. And Hazel actually, I think, suggested the railroad fair. Well, he knew it was nothing that Lily would be interested in, and certainly the girls wouldn't be interested in it at their age. So he looked around the studio and saw Ward was a rail nut. And so these two grown men went off to, today I would refer to the same activity that I would engage in as nerding out with one of my friends. You know, I have friends that I will go and do Disney activities with or go look at historic sites and stuff. And basically, Walt and Ward went and nerded out at the railroad fair. The thing I think that was really critical about that was it did give him a lot of time to relax and to reflect and to enjoy something that he had such a passion for. And it re-stimulated his fascination with trains, and I think led to a lot of his then his work on his model railroading hobby. During that trip, also, he and Ward went to Greenfield Village, Henry Ford's Greenfield Village. And I think something about that place spoke to his heart. It came at the same time as they were talking about essentially, what we would say today, maximizing revenue streams. Of course, they didn't say that in those days. But that was when they were talking about doing the little park across the street from the studio and giving a studio tour and little picnic park kind of thing. And I think the trip to the railroad fair really solidified a lot of his ideas for what a Disney park might look like and feel like. So absolutely correct. The railroad fair trip was influential and important, I think, on several levels. I think it reconnected and sort of revitalized him in a lot of important ways. that once again informed and influenced what he did from that time on.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of his inspiration for what we see in Disneyland today came out of that trip. Another trip that you talk about, that this seemed like such a whirlwind trip to me, was there in your book Travels with Walt Disney, Photographic Voyage Around the World, it's that 1935 trip to Europe that Walt and Roy went on with Edna and Lillian. And I mean, talk about, you know, this really was the grand tour of Europe. And this was really a significant trip for both of them. I mean, it seemed like it was sort of a working trip for Roy and a PR trip for Walt in a lot of ways.
I think also, once again, one of the important takeaways from that 1935 trip, of course, this was part of the discovery of the travels with Walt Disney, was finding out how much he traveled by ship. And that was pretty interesting stuff. And of course, Didier Getz has covered this particular trip in his book, Disney's Grand Tour. So the depth of detail of what went on during that European trip, the thing that fascinates me is how crazy people went for Walt Disney. Walt Disney as celebrity. This is, I think, sort of the first big manifestation of the name Walt Disney having so much meaning for audiences all over the world. I mean, he was practically mobbed at public appearances when he went on this tour, on this trip. His arrival in London was described in one of the papers as the craziest mass interview I've ever attended. Everybody wanted to talk to him. They wanted to know about him. He had this huge international sensations with Mickey Mouse and the Silly Symphonies. He was beginning at home to work on Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I think this trip was so much about recognizing the international impact that his funny little cartoons we're having all around the world. He said to a reporter that he thought it was surprising to think about what an international personage Mickey had become, and that people in Paris knew Mickey and in London and Rome as much as they did in any town in the United States. They knew who Mickey was. I think this was revelatory to him, and I think really made him realize culturally. I think financially, of course, he probably looked at the releases and the income from foreign markets and all that stuff and went, I think it didn't really hit him until this trip about how the characters and culture of Disney really had begun to resonate worldwide.
Yeah, and that what he created was meaningful to people around the world, not just in the United States.
And this is the great alchemy of Disney, isn't it? Even to this day. I had this discussion in Marceline again, which is the culture of Disney has emotional resonance for people that's so deep because everybody has personalized a Disney experience into their own life, which in turn makes people very protective and very proprietary about Disney, even if it's their little piece of the Disney culture or their little element that they're especially interested in. It's an enormous strength for the company. I always warn people, the company is one thing and the Disney culture is a different thing. They coexist and they cohabit and they need each other, but I discourage people from getting too hung up about, you know, watching the stock market or the box office grosses if that's not what their area of interest is. If they're interested in the culture of Disney, Disney is Disney forever and ever. Amen.
I agree. And, you know, we've talked on the show before, and I know I've talked about it with, you know, Walt's grandchildren, how really Walt reshaped and redefined childhood for generations. In that, and I think it's what you said, Disney is such an ingrained part of childhood for so many generations. We can't imagine, we don't know what childhood was like before him. And can't imagine what it would. Yeah. Yeah. And it, can you imagine?
I remember you. Go ahead.
No. Well, I was thinking, when we think of the influences that modern technology can expose children to these days, because you're the parent of three young children, so you certainly are dealing with this, is that what if we didn't have Disney? I mean, Disney now is almost the grounding of childhood in a way.
It's an absolute cultural foundation, I think, in a lot of ways. And I think a lot of us who become Disney fans plug into it based on a childhood experience. And I remember I always sort of relate to the fact that Disney offers doorways that are understandable and safe into larger ideas. And I used the, for instance, about how I learned about Abraham Lincoln because of Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And it made me want to understand better why he was so important, that you would make this enormous, reverent, respectful show about him. I learned about Benjamin Disraeli because his encyclopedia entry was always after Walt Disney's in the encyclopedia. I'd read Walt, the World Book, and I'd read Britannica, and Benjamin Disraeli was always the next one, so I would keep going. What's interesting to me is, you said, this redefining childhood, and I remember I owe a great deal of my personal culture to my grandmother, who spent an awful lot of time and attention with me when I was a kid, because I know this will absolutely amaze you and your listeners. I was one weird kid. I liked watching cartoons. I liked reading comic books. I liked reading in general. I liked listening to music. I was not about sports. I was not about that kind of activity. I was really interested in history and cultural history, and I had a grandmother who helped me do all of that. I remember one day asking her, "Grandma, did you love Mickey as much as I do when you were a little girl?" And my grandmother absolutely shocked me by saying, "When I was a little girl, there was no Mickey Mouse." My grandmother was born in 1911.
Oh, wow.
Mickey Mouse didn't come about until she was an adult. Mm-hmm. And that was shocking to me. And it led me even more to explore what the pre-Disney childhood was about through my grandmother. And she showed me, and she still had copies of storybooks that she had from when she was a child, but it's something that I learned and sort of echoed in learning about Walt Disney. She said, you know, it was a sharing of stories that came about in many different ways, from sitting in the parlor or the living room or the family room and listening to someone play the piano or play the violin, or from going to, I mean, once again, it sounds archetypal and it sounds corny, but in the summer you would go to the park and listen to concerts, and you would share books back and forth, and going to the new Carnegie Free Libraries was a really big deal, because a lot of towns didn't have civic libraries, county libraries. So the Carnegie Library System. And I learned a lot about how the culture was communicated prior to Walt Disney sort of creating this venue for childhood, as you pointed out. creating, once again, this sort of foundational storytelling culture where you share it from generation to generation. And anymore, it can be anything. There are parents now who are sharing The Little Mermaid, or they're sharing Lilo and Stitch with their young children because that's the movie I saw when I was a little girl, or that's the place I went. I went to Disneyland when I was a little boy, and we're going to go there now. So it's this sharing generationally of those feelings and those experiences, and it goes all the way back to practically the foundation of Disney back in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. Passing Mickey Mouse along to your kids was probably the first manifestation of that.
Yes. Oh, definitely. And it's interesting. First of all, I had the same kind of childhood you did. So when you were describing you're a weird kid, I thought, wait, that's normal for me. But but I remember when I graduated from like reading comic books and things like that into like more, you know, big boy books or whatever you want to call it, was because, you know, when Disney released the films every 7 years, when I saw Treasure Island, Swiss Family Robinson, and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, I told my parents, I want to read the books that these are based on. They were thrilled. And that launched me on loving literature and seeing Johnny Tremaine and Westward Ho, The Wagons. It got me, it got me interested in reading about history. And now I love history. So.
Well, I'm looking at a big stack of books right next to my desk here in my office. It's a big stack of Scholastic and Pocket books because kids today don't know the era of like the 50-cent paperback book at the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
Remember those big turning stands of pocketbooks and paperback books? Every Disney movie that came out had some corresponding book release. And that's when I really started diving in and read By the Great Horn Spoon by Sid Fleischman, because Bullwhip Griffin was based on that. I read The Golden Evenings of Summer by Will Stanton because Charlie and the Angel was based on that. I have Blackbeard's Ghost by Ben Stahl. I've got Island at the Top of the World and Dodie Smith's 101 Dalmatians. And, you know, I read all of them because they were plugged into Disney in a certain way. Then, of course, the other thing it taught me as I did that was I began to see the choices that filmmakers make when they adapt a piece of literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that I was like, you know, the sharpest tool in the shed by any means, but I started to see, oh, you know, this story, it's all the same characters, but the storyline is all different. So clearly they liked all of these really interesting characters, but didn't think the story would make a good movie. So, it you know, once again, the whole Disney thing just opens doors, especially, I think, if you are, as most of the fans that I've met and Walt himself, if you're naturally curious, if you just like to know how things are done or why things are done. I think it's just, once again, it's in many ways, it's a self-perpetuating culture in that sense. Because then you have people like you and people like me who learn a lot about this, and our great joy is passing it on.
Mm-hmm.
Our, you know, the great fun of doing what I do. A lot of people get into collecting or they get into having a hobby and they, because it's about ownership. I get into this and got into this as a career because it's more interesting to share it.
I like that.
To be able to get somebody excited and interested, and this is, once again, it's like a lot of my younger friends, I have to remind myself that they don't know a lot of this stuff. So when I say you should read this book, or you know what, here's a link to a YouTube video you should watch that's about some aspect of Disney culture or history, I just love seeing how flipped out they get about things that I kind of take for granted, given my 30 plus years of professional nerding out.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is the great joy of, and I think that's, to tell you the truth, is the joy of any sort of subculture in this sense. I think that it's probably the same with people who are interested in the history of baseball or stamp collecting or anything like that. You find your like-minded subculture, and that's what you do. You share it. I find that the most satisfying thing about my whole Disney experience to a large degree.
Well, and you do a great job at it.
Thank you.
But speaking of another trip that Walt went on, again, when it was at a real critical emotional time for him, you know, the studio was on strike. Walt was not taking it well. Roy needed to deal with it without Walt. And then the State Department comes along and says, hey, we're dealing with South America. Are they going to ally with, you know, the Axis? Are they going to ally with us? And so they sent Walt Disney and the studio down there on a goodwill trip to South America. And again, not only did this benefit the relationship between the United States and South American countries during World War II, but this, again, it was another pivotal moment for Walt and the Walt Disney Studio.
Well, and what's interesting is that Walt's first reaction was absolutely not. They asked him to do it, and he said no, because they wanted him to go and wave from a car and shake hands and stuff. He said, I don't do that. I'm not a glad hander. I'm not that kind of guy. But then when they worked it out that he could actually go down there and do some actual work, do some investigative and sort of generous communication and appropriation of cultural elements, his whole notion of not just going down there and being an American waving and being friendly, but seeking out cultural elements that would be of interest back home so that the relationship would be, once again, Americans would become proprietary about what Walt called the APC countries, the Argentine and Brazil and Chile. He could not only just go down there and say, hi, I'm a wonderful American that you all love. Stick with us Yanks, we're pretty good guys. Indeed, he turned around and brought a great deal of the Latin American and South American culture back to the United States and said, these are our neighbors. I mean, the whole notion of saludos amigos is hello friends. He brought back music, he brought back art, he brought back storytelling that most American audiences had never seen and never would experience. And once again, I think that the handshake that worked both ways from that trip to South America is the big story of the big Walt story of the South America trip, the El Grupo trip. Now, if your listeners have not seen Ted Thomas's amazing documentary film, Walt and El Grupo, it is absolutely a must see because the richness and depth with which he covers both the detail and what so often I think is missed in a lot of documentaries is the why. You'll see documentaries and they give you all sorts of, you know, sort of chronological and procedural information, but they don't really examine a lot of the why. And the thing that Ted's documentary does so well is it examines the impact he had on people there, which you don't get that story a lot of the time from eyewitness accounts and from the places themselves. And then, of course, J.B. Kaufman did a corresponding book about Walt's relationship with South America. Now, we've all seen the beginning of Saludos Amigos. That's one of the things that I have in Travels with Walt that I think is kind of funny. You've got Walt boarding the plane and getting on the Pan Am, I think it was, and getting ready to head out, and his artists like Herb Ryman and Mary Blair are getting on the plane with him. And what I found out in working on this book is they actually had forgotten to shoot any of that when they actually left. So for the sake of Saludos Amigos, they shot the departure after they actually came back so that they would have the sort of home movie continuity at the beginning of it. So that's very famous from both of those, the book, the documentary. The trip itself is very well documented. The plane flight is part of Saludos Amigos. What I found most interesting was the part that never really gets talked about, which is coming home. And that part of the trip doesn't get talked about, but basically Walt and Lily and some of the group wound up in Chile at the end of that El Grupo tour. And the way to get home from Chile, and I think another thing, if you watch Ted's film and you read the book, that whole group didn't stop for the whole time that they were down there on that trip. They went to parties and events and receptions, and they worked. They worked on story development. They worked on artwork. They went places and documented with their brushes and pens beautiful locations and people and picked up storytelling. But Walt said at the end of it, I was so worn out by the time we got to the end of that trip in Chile, they found out that they could take a ship, a passenger ship home. So they left South America on the Grace Line Santa Clarita, or Santa Clara, the liner Santa Clara. And that was a 17-day voyage for them to get back to Los Angeles. And Walt found, as he said later in his life, he found that an ocean voyage was really the only place that he ever could really relax. Now, I'm not sure that he didn't find in later years that Palm Springs was pretty darn relaxing, but he was still close to work, and he still brought work with him when he went to Palm Springs. But think about it, on a sea voyage in those days, there was no way to get at him. He was gone. You would basically say, Walter's gone for 17 days. You might be able to send a wire, but there was like no, certainly no internet, no ship-to-shore radio that wasn't prohibitively difficult or expensive to deal with. So Walt could really and genuinely feel on an ocean voyage like he was getting away. He also said at a certain point on an ocean voyage, he stopped paying attention to time, which I find it's hard to do when I'm on a Disney cruise because I have presentations and signings and appointments and stuff. But, and of course, there's always activities and port calls and things like that. But he said, at one point, you know, at home, I don't get up anywhere later than 6:30 in the morning. And he would find that on the ship, he could sleep in. I mean, we sort of all take for granted that maybe one or two days a week we can sleep in and not have the alarm clock go off and not have anywhere we have to be in the morning. This was a very different world for Walt to be able to sleep until 9:30 or 10 in the morning. And once again, it was because he was on a ship. I was really surprised at how many ocean voyages that he and Lily took, beginning with that Gypsy Jaunt. But they were initial early cruisers to Hawaii. The Matson line had started a passenger cruise business. So they were really sort of innovators in the, what do you want to call them? Ships to Nowhere, mm-hmm. where sort of the cruise is the trip. But their nowhere happened to be Hawaii. And they started that in the late 1920s and built the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. So you would get on a Matson liner in Los Angeles or San Francisco and sail to Hawaii. And then you'd stay at their hotel and you know, wiggle your toes in the sand and that sort of thing. So Walt and Lily started doing that in the 30s. And they went in, I think, 1934, I think. And then they went with Roy and Edna in 39. And then with the girls several times, three or four times when the girls were young. They went on these family ocean voyages to Hawaii. And then, of course, ocean liners were, to a large degree, the way you got to Europe back in the old days, too. So they were on the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth and the SS United States, and they did a lot of liner travel to and from Europe during the course of Walt's lifetime. So lots of sailing that I hadn't really... The whole thing with Travels with Walt Disney was, it's looking at Walt's life through a different kind of prism is always really interesting to me.
Right.
And when we started to assemble this book, it was, I don't think I'd ever really sat down and connected all of his travels.
You know, I was going to say that, and then I think it leads to what you were going to say, is that when you, like, you know, he did all those live action films after World War II, and he was the producer of those films, and it wasn't just that they slapped his name on it, he was the producer. And then you list them all, and that he traveled to locations for every single one of those. And I thought, yeah, you're right. This, I mean, he traveled the world just to produce his films. And
well,
it
that was
the
interesting thing, too. Yeah. He was actually a producer, much like with the El Grupo trip. He wasn't going down there and, you know, waving and getting the press coverage and then, you know, walking on the set and making happy with the stars and then going away. He was on the set. Mm-hmm. He was looking through the script. He was working with the director. He was helping to determine shot setups. There's one photo in the book that's really charming where he's on location with, I think it's the Moonspinners in Greece, and he's sitting next to the sound recordist and he's listening to the sound playback.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really interesting that he really was, and of course we all forget, where did he start? He started off making movies. He started off taking A.V. Cogger's camera home from Kansas City Film Ad and making trick films and figuring out what the camera could do. I think people tend to forget that Walt was a movie maker, because we all, that was the other unusual thing about looking at the travel and the travel, his travels through photographs. There's a gorgeous photo of him on horseback on the location of Sword in the Rose. And it's strange looking if you don't remember context. What's strange looking is TV Walt is on horseback. And by that I mean he has on a business suit and a tie. And yet here he is on this beautifully dressed horse. And then, of course, you stop and think, oh, yeah. Walt was a horseman. He was an equestrian. He played polo. Of course, that's not weird. But the identities of Walt that you get so sort of commingled across his lifetime, it's just a funny juxtaposition. And it makes you remember what a multifaceted fellow he was. And I think, of course, too, the reputation that he gained after his passing, this whole idea of Walt as sort of this wealthy, ultra-conservative developer, greedy developer, wanting to, you know, tear down nature and build amusement parks, all of this sort of BS that led Diane to a large degree to make a whole museum about her dad. We forget how amazingly nuanced Walt's life was and how the breadth of his experience, of his interests, and of his activities, we forget. That's one of the things within the book, too, looking at his photos from early California, where he and Lily enjoyed the California dream of the 1920s and 30s, which was reaching out your kitchen window and picking an orange off your own orange tree.
Mm-hmm.
And if you went for an hour that way, you were at the Pacific Ocean. And if you went an hour that way, you were in the San Bernardino Mountains. And you see that California dream played out by Walton and Lily, where you see them at Lake Arrowhead or at Yosemite doing winter sports. They're skiing or skating. It really brings a richness to the perception of really who was this guy. And like I said, I didn't really start to examine it through that prism until I sat down to try to figure out how this book made sense.
Mm-hmm.
The book came about in this very sort of interesting way. I had been asked to do another Disney cruise. And my contact at the cruise line had said, let's do something new. because I will give them sort of a slate of presentations that I already have done. We were doing a transatlantic, and she said, let's do one that's about the port cities that we're going to. So I put together a presentation and found a Disney Stories in every port, including Reykjavik, Iceland, which I was really proud of. Then we wound up not porting in Reykjavik because of the weather, so that was kind of sad. But the other one, I said, well, and really, this is the genesis of this book, I said, let's look at making something nautical. Let's do something like Walt Disney on the High Seas. And initially I thought, well, I knew about the European trip on the Rex, on the Italian liner Rex, because the famous photos and the ones we used at the museum of Walt mm-hmm. in the white coat. And the thought I had was, I can sort of pad this out with, you know, boat builders and sea scouts and some stories about the Columbia sailing ship. And, you know, we can make a sort of nautical fun thing. But then I started drilling down and it's like, oh my gosh. And that's where I found the Santa Clara line trip from El Grupo and all that stuff. And I put together this presentation, Walt Disney on the High Seas. One of the passengers came up afterwards and said, I would love to be able to get that in a little book in the gift store. I think that would be so neat to have on board the Disney Cruise Lines, just a little paperback, easy to transport. So when I got home, I made a PDF of my keynote presentation, and I sent it off to my book editor and said, is there a book here or am I nuts? And she wrote back and said, yes, you're nuts, but there's a book here. So, you know, she agreed on both fronts. But she said, I don't know if you're thinking big enough. Let's look at making like a little travel journal, because Walt went everywhere. Bingo. There's where he went. So I started trying to put together a narrative logic, because I hate chronological stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing it as sort of a log that went from point, you know, chronology point A in 18 or whatever, until his death in 1966 seemed about the most boring way in the world to put this together. And, you know, once again, if you want timelines and chronologies and data, I used to have this argument with Diane Disney Miller at the museum all the time. I would say the museum is not a place for data. Museum is a place for experience that leads you to find out the data. It's a place for you to feel something so that you go study more of the facts and figures. Museum is a place where you can learn about why and then find out what and when later on. Well, I had sort of the same approach to this book. I thought, what's going to be interesting ways to group these? So what I started with was visuals. I started looking at the photography. I started looking at the record keeping. And Becky Klein, the director of the Disney Archives, gave me a wonderful document. When she found out about the book, she handed me a file folder one day in the archives and said, I've been putting this together for years and I never knew exactly why. But it basically was a chronology of Walt's travels based on studio records, date books, his daily calendar, tickets, press articles. She had just been accumulating this day-by-day information for ages. Well, that led me to go and look things up in the photo library and to look for images. And then as I started to look at the images, the choice was, what do these images reveal? Do they reveal an anecdote? Do they reveal a critical point in Walt's biography? Do they reveal a sort of connection to something that happened later? What are the nuances and the layers of the storytelling that can happen? That led me then to look at grouping things in a somewhat unconventional way by destinations and modes of transportation. So that's why it's sort of built the way it is, with something about his early life, because I wanted to provide a context from which all his travels emanated. Of course, you can't do a book about travel in Walt Disney without a whole section on trains. So that became the second chapter. Of course, the train took him to California, and there were all sorts of little trips within California. There were trips as little as going from his home in Brentwood to Pasadena to be the Grand Marshal of the Rose Parade. But there were trips to film locations that were in California, specifically so dear to my heart. Then we got in the next chapter was really my presentation that I had done on the cruise line about Walt on the High Seas. But of course, then you're going to go trains, you're going to go boats, you got to go in the sky. So, and of course, Walt's fascination with flying was almost the same and gets lots less coverage. But Lily talks in one interview about how they used to go stand at the airport and watch the planes take off and land because it was so fascinating to him. Then, of course, he bought three different company planes during the course of his lifetime. Mm-hmm. Then we looked at what you were talking about earlier. A lot of why he traveled was to go and see his movies being shot. So basically in the 50s and 60s, you know, that 15-year span from Treasure Island until he passed away, he would go all over the place. He went on location to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. He went to Jamaica for that. He went to England for Treasure Island and Sword in the Rose and Rob Roy, the Highland Rogue. And he became something of an Anglophile when he was over there. Of course, the thing that I was missing in putting the book together, I didn't really have an ending. And then I kept thinking about Walt as a citizen of the world, about how that's such a dichotomy in a certain way to think of, you know, as I was saying before, this Walt after his death being perceived as sort of the grand, granite-carved, ugly American, you know, isolationist and rich and mean and all of those things that people started layering on him that weren't true. But I thought, you know what? This guy was really a citizen of the world. He really was a world traveler. And then the light bulb came on over my head and I went, oh my gosh. And then what he did after a lifetime of traveling all around the world, he made a destination so the world could come see him.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. He built Disneyland and the world came to him.
There could be no better finale to a book about Walt's travels than to show some of the great photography. And once again, Michael Buckoff at the Disney Photo Library and Becky Klein and Archives had just found and digitally scanned and restored a whole big set of VIP visitors to Disneyland photos. I think it was for two expos ago. And I remembered that and I sent a note over and said, can you send me a contact sheet? And they did. And so the book's sort of grand finale now is sort of the international appeal of Disneyland itself. And so we have, fantastic stuff. I think a lot of it has probably either not been published or was published so long ago, but you know, the scope and variety of visitors, domestic and international. And it's just fun to see Walt with you know, the King of Belgium and the Shah of Iran, and it's sort of fascinating to think that in his lifetime, he had become this world figure. You know, it was Walt with the King of Morocco, you know, or with Prime Minister Nehru of India. It's just, he had become such a world-renowned figure that these people wanted to be photographed with him. So it created a wonderful sort of circle to the storytelling of what the book was about.
I agree.
It's one of those things where sometimes you just sort of, you're trying so hard to create some story logic, to create some narrative structure, and there it is right in front of your face the whole time. Mm-hmm. I sort of did one of those smack my head moments and went, well, of course. What's the result of a lifetime of traveling the world? Make a place that the world can come see you.
Yes, exactly. And a couple of the notes I had had on it was, and you were bringing up the photographs. There are photographs in here that are very rare or have never been publicly published, because a lot of these I've never seen. And I've seen a lot of photographs. I mean, and they're just so beautifully laid out. And
The book designer, Glendon Lee, did a phenomenal job of creating a rich texture visually between text, images, and fun little sort of artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And a way of calling out pull quotes and things like that. So it gives it an enormous visual variety. We also had little napkin sketches done. We commissioned an artist to create little line drawings. And the thought was, do something that an artist or a traveler would do while they're sitting and waiting to board a plane.
Mm-hmm.
Or while they're sitting at a restaurant in a foreign city.
See, so I imagined that Walt would doodle something like that. I thought it was such a nice little addition to the book, nice little touch.
and that was really our intent. Our intent was to create a sense that this is what creative people do when they travel.
Mm-hmm.
And it also just gives it another layer of texture in terms of the visuals. In terms of the photographs themselves, there are a great many here that either have not been published since their initial use for basically a newspaper or a Sunday magazine or a mass market magazine, or haven't been published before at all.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, it was that access to the Walt Disney Archives photo library, and they're just so generously cooperative. And the nice thing is, the people that I work with at Disney and at Disney Publishing, they get excited about these books too. And you can see it sort of raises the whole enterprise up when you get a group of people who are all passionate about it and excited by it. It winds up really creating, once again, like the museum, I wanted to create something. I talked about this the other day with some colleagues of mine. I said, our great benefit, I think, is that we all work on projects that we would buy ourselves. And we're not happy with sort of second best. So it sort of makes us work extra hard to go, would I plunk down $30 for this? Yeah, I really would.
Yeah.
So we try to do that on all the projects that we've got going on.
And a question that I know I had, and I think you addressed it, was one of the things I've learned about authors is size of book is very important, how they determine what size. And I just thought, I really liked the size of this book because I like to read in bed, and I like to read out in the garden, or I like to tuck a book with me if I have to go out to an appointment, because as I'm waiting, I can sit and read it. And the trend to these big coffee table books is they're lovely, but it's really hard to read one of those when you're trying to sit up in bed at night, you know, reading or take with you to an appointment. And yours is, when you said it's like a travel journal, I thought, exactly, because this was just so easy for me to pick up and read anywhere.
And that's, I think, when you're doing a book, and the books that I've been working on more recently, I've had a lot more direct involvement in making these decisions. Because you're absolutely right. Everything from the trim size to the binding to the weight and quality of the paper does something to your storytelling. So we've gotten very careful, and I've gotten very involved in being a part of that decision-making process. I'm so absolutely lucky that my two editors that I work with most at Disney Editions are completely on board. They're people that I've worked with for a very long time, and that we have a great mutual respect. And making those decisions as part of a brain trust, and with the book designers too. My next book coming out, I worked with a very longtime friend who's an incredible designer. And all of us are nerds. All of us want to make books that we would be proud to go buy and that we're proud to give to our family and our friends and say, this is what I do. So the way that you present the book, exactly to your point, is a way to be additive to the story you're telling. And that came back, as I said, right from the get-go when I sent the idea for a little Walt the Sailor book, which was, why don't you do a travel journal? Travel journal stuck in my head through the whole development process. And that was where the idea of the little hotel bills and luggage tags being sort of stuck here and there, just to give a feel that it might somehow be an album that was carried along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't make any claim that that's what this is, but I wanted it to feel like that.
Oh, it does. It's just a wonderful book. I know our listeners will really enjoy this book. What do you hope people take away from Travels with Walt Disney, A Photographic Voyage Around the World, after they read it?
Once again, all of my work involving the biographical and personal story of Walt Disney goes really back to what Diane wanted, which was, Walt was not a plaster saint. He wasn't, you know, put on earth by God and, you know, rays of sunshine coming out of his forehead. But much like the reputation that followed him after his death, he was not a devil. He wasn't an awful man. He wasn't all of the things, you know, that sort of churn up all the time. Oh, he was a racist. He was a misogynist. He was an anti-Semite. Diane said the greatest compliment that we could give to him is to recognize that he was a man. He was a very human man. He happened to be an utter genius. But I would love people to take away a realization that there's nuance and complexity to Walt that they may not have thought of before, but that also what he was engaged in was a very human experience, traveling and participating, observing. On another layer, it's very interesting to see how these things sort of cross-pollinated and led to other things or fed into other ideas. If a reader takes away a sense of a greater richness of understanding who Walt Disney was and why things happened the way they did, then I've done an okay job with what I really wanted people to feel about him by looking at this book.
I think you were successful. I think you hit the mark there. Now, how can our listeners obtain a copy of Travels with Walt Disney?
Well, luckily, Travels with Walt Disney is out in bookstores already. It's been out for a couple months, doing pretty well. You can find it on Shop Disney. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's out there, and it's fairly easy to find in bookstores and online is out where it is. So if you use your fancy new Googles and look that thing up, you're gonna find it.
Yeah, and as we're heading into vacation season, this is a great book to read when you're on vacation or when you're thinking of your vacation or
something. You know what, it's kind of a fun beach book too. And
yeah.
I always in terms of the way this book is structured, I said to somebody, well, it's kind of a bathtub book. Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, yeah, you can read it from beginning to end because there is something of a narrative arc to it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also get into the bathtub and put on some music and open that book to any page and just start digging in.
Exactly.
So it has that same appeal as a beach book or a bathtub book.
Now, you have a book coming out that I am really excited about. The minute I saw this pop up on Amazon, I pre-ordered it. And because this, they always have a tiny exhibit of the Disney Christmas cards at the Walt Disney Family Museum every year. That's one of my must-to things to do during the holidays. And you are coming out with From All of Us to All of You, the Disney Christmas card. So what can you share with us about this book?
This book is one that I have wanted to do for 20 years. I actually sold this book idea to Disney Publishing in 2008, and then it got shelved. And I'm kind of feeling lucky that it got shelved because it was heading in a direction that I didn't think was the book that I wanted. And that happens sometimes. You pitch a book and then it gets reformatted, it gets reduced in scope or scale, or as you said, you know, in the binding, the way that the book is presented, it changed so much that it wasn't the book I wanted. And I was actually a little relieved that it got shelved in about 2008, 2009. About 18 months ago or so, not too long ago, I brought it back to my editors and showed them what had been done. And they took it to sales, and the sales group was all over it. Now, if any of your listeners have the Disney Maps book, the one that has the sort of center stage open, and of course, we started that center stage open binding with the theater book back in 2007 or whenever that was. But the Maps book was the same center open format. So this Disney Christmas card, From All of Us to All of You, the Disney Christmas card, is the same format and the same trim size as the Disney Maps book. And it is not only a sort of a chronological trip through the history of Disney over the decades, accompanied by all of the Disney Studio, Disney Company Christmas cards from the first one in 1930 to the most recent one. We even had a Christmas card commissioned that Lorelei Bove, the artist, Disney artist, Disney animation artist, did for us. She did a new prep and landing Christmas card for us for the book. But within the book are a dozen removable, specially made cards that feature interesting and rare Christmas-themed art from Disney across the years. There's a couple of never-before-published Kevin Kidney illustrations from a video project that he did. There's a wonderful sort of holiday arc of storytelling that not only shows us these beautiful, these Christmas cards are indescribable in the sense that the caliber of the art that was created for a lot of the Disney cards is breathtaking. They're amazing. From the quality of the artwork to some of them, the paper mechanics are extraordinary. But it's also a group of artists that created the artwork from Tom Wood and Hank Porter in the very early days of the Disney cards, up through and including Paul Wenzel, who's sort of an unsung hero artist of mine at the Disney studio, John Hench, Mary Blair, and even John Jensen, who in the 80s and 90s took over in corporate graphics. So not only representations of all their art, but little sidebars and biographies of the artists who made them, and material about the context of the times in which the cards were created. So it gives a sort of, once again, a more layered picture, not just flip a page, there's a card, flip a page, there's a card. There's a storytelling about this as an aspect of the Disney culture, I think, that people will appreciate and enjoy as much as the art itself.
Well, I hope you will come back on the show and talk about that book when it's released. So, and that's coming out in September of 2018,
September 18th is the street date. So plenty of time to pre-order and plenty of time to get ready for Christmas, because I think it's a terrific gift book. I think it's going to be under a whole lot of Disney fan Christmas trees this year.
I think so. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us and helping us to connect with Walt through stories about his travels.
Absolutely, my pleasure. You know, I think, as I've said so often, the three most influential men in my childhood were, sorry, Dad, Walt Disney and the Sherman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that I can do to keep Walt's name and work and spirit alive is something that's a tribute back to him and to his daughter, Diane, for all the work that she did in trying to preserve and perpetuate his work and his name. So it's absolutely my pleasure.
Well, thank you. Well, we'll look forward to having you on the show again. Well, we are now at that time of the show where it is This Day in Disney History. It is our big quiz where you can at home play along with us, test your knowledge against our contestants, and see how do you fare. How is your knowledge of Disney history for the week of June 3rd this time? But remember, if you're playing along, you have to remember our rules for our home edition. No yahooing, no binging, no googling or anything else like that. You're on your scout's honor here. So of course we do have our returning champion, Craig Williams, but also from our West Coast team, we have one of my colleagues. We have Luella. And Luella, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce your last name because it will all go terribly wrong. So Luella, I'm going to let you introduce yourself here.
Hello. Yes, it's Luella Loriola. And Tyler messes it up all the time.
I know.
But everyone else does too. So you're good. You're in good company if you mess up my name. Now, and I will say, I married into this. My parents didn't do this to me.
Yes. Yes. Listeners to our old Disneyland show will know Luella because she appeared quite frequently on it as one of our guests' contributors. And if you watch the Best and Worst of Disneyland video series, which I highly encourage you to do because it is a fun series to watch, Luella is a regular on that show. So anyway, and so Luella, how did you come to the Diz? Because I think your story is very similar to mine. You were a fan, you were a listener, and then you became part of the team. So tell us your journey.
Yes, well, I stumbled upon the Diz when I was doing research for my first ever big trip to Walt Disney World. And it was one of the podcasts that I really appreciated that shared honest opinions. And I was making my big lifetime trip. And at the same time, I had booked a Diz cruise on the Bahamas, which just so happened to coincide with one of the podcast crews. And that's where my love of the Diz Unplugged started and where my knowledge of Disney just kind of increased tenfold. And it goes from there. Met the Disneyland team, and they were having some meetups because I'm from Southern California, and that's how I found the Disneyland podcast and met some team members there. Used to go to the meetups, and I was really into Run Disney, and that's how I first started contributing, talking a little bit about the Run Disney side of the Disneyland podcast, and kind of grew from there. And I've learned a lot about just Disney history, Walt Disney World, Disneyland, Disney Cruise Line, and was really honored to be asked to join the team. So here I am today.
And we are delighted to have you. And what's nice is your perspective is that, you know, you're married, you're a mom of three boys, a variety of ages. So you know what it's like to have a teenager at the park, and also two youngsters.
So, yes, that's true. I do have my 16-year-old who's in those little teenage years but has been raised with loving Disneyland. And then I have a 9-year-old special needs boy, so it's a different trip with him. And then I have my rowdy 6-year-old who is a typical 6-year-old kid at Disneyland that puts the bubbles in everyone's faces.
Yes. Yeah, so you bring some really good perspectives.
Thank you.
To the show. So we appreciate it. Well, since you say you know a lot about Disney history, Craig, you might be getting a run for your money here.
I am not confident on this one, and that doesn't happen really often. So, but I am afraid that this finally be the time that I go down.
We'll see. I'll try my best.
Well, as I mentioned, we are going to be looking at Disney events for the week of June 3rd. Now, for our listeners at home, and you know, new listeners who are playing along, the rules are: if our contestants choose not to hear the multiple choice questions, multiple choice answers, they will receive 3 points for a correct answer. If they do choose to hear the multiple choice options, they will receive 2 points for a correct answer. If they ask to have one of the incorrect answers removed, they will then receive 1 point for a correct answer. However, if their opponent answers a question incorrectly, they will have the opportunity to steal that question and receive 1 point for the correct answer. So do we have any questions before we begin?
I think I'm ready.
Okay, Craig, are you ready?
Oh, of course I'm ready.
Okay, excellent. All right, now, Luella, since you are our guest on Connecting with Walt, we will give you the option. Would you like to receive the first question or pass it on to Craig? And there is strategy in this.
I'm going to receive the first question.
All right. So this first question is for, actually, this, I'm sorry, I've been saying June 3rd this whole time. This is actually, I didn't change my heading. This is actually for June 10th. So because I looked at the first question and look at that. All right, so this is for June 10th. So hopefully it doesn't throw anybody off. Okay, so June 10th, Thelma Howard passed away on June 10th, 1994, shortly before her 80th birthday. What is her Disney connection? Thelma Howard. Sounds like she should be on the Andy Griffith Show, doesn't it?
Okay. You know, the name actually sounds familiar. And I do believe has a connection with Walt Disney, like a personal connection. So not necessarily something with the studios. Oh, my gosh. Let's go with the multiple choice.
All right. So A, was Thelma Howard one of the first ink and paint girls at the Disney Brothers studio and had worked with Lillian Bounds Disney and Edna Disney on the original Mickey Mouse cartoon shorts? Or B, she was Walt and Lillian's live-in housekeeper and cook for 30 years? C, she was one of three actresses hired to portray Aunt Jemima at Disneyland from 1955 to 1964. She was the hostess of the Aunt Jemima Pancake House in Frontierland and the annual pancake race on National Pancake Day. D. She was the first attraction hostess hired for Disneyland's Fantasyland in 1955.
Okay, I really think it is more of a personal connection. I'm going to say B. I think she actually, I'm going to go with B. I think she was their personal housekeeper.
And very good. You are correct. The answer is B. Thelma Howard, the Disney's live-in housekeeper and cook for 30 years. Beginning in 1951 at the age of 38, she passed away just shy of her 80th birthday. She was nicknamed Fufu, and Walt often referred to her as the real-life Mary Poppins. As a housekeeper for the Disney family, she received a few shares of Disney stock as a Christmas gift from Walt, as well as for birthdays and special events. But she lived frugally throughout her life, not wanting to sell her stock out of loyalty to Walt and his family. Unbeknownst to herself, she was a multimillionaire at the time of her death.
Wow. So what happens with that stock when she passes?
Actually, when we talked about it on the Eat Like Walt episode with Marcy Smothers, Diane Disney Miller, who had been making sure that Selma was cared for.
I remember.
When she retired, they actually set up a foundation for Selma Howard's name for some of the causes that she cared about, causes for children and other things. So.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Very good. 2 points right off the bat.
Excellent. Yay.
There you go. Okay, Craig, to you, June 11th. These popular attractions officially debuted at Disney California Adventure on June 11th, 2010.
I will go with multiple choice.
Is it A, World of Color and Silly Symphony Swings? B, The Little Mermaid, Ariel's Undersea Adventure and Goofy's Sky School? C, World of Color and The Little Mermaid, Ariel's Undersea Adventure? Or D, Silly Symphony Swings and Goofy's Sky School? You may have covered this.
Yeah, I could be completely wrong. I thought Goofy's Sky School was there before. So I could be wrong, but I'm going to go ahead and eliminate those two. But I probably shouldn't have just announced that in case I decide to ask for one to go away. So that didn't do me any favors. The big thing is I don't remember when Little Mermaid opened up. Because I know when it opened up here, it had to be around 2000. I started with the Diz at that point. It was 2012. And I know they didn't open up like right in line with each other, but 2 years also seems like a big gap. I will go with,
do you want me to run through these again?
Yeah, you can run through the two that didn't include Goofy Sky School. The only other one, sorry.
Okay, there's two. There's World of Color and Silly Symphony Swings.
Okay.
Or World of Color and The Little Mermaid, Ariel's Undersea Adventure. The other two involved Goofy Sky School.
I'm going to say A, the one with the swings. I don't remember seeing that in the back when there was like the big orange and all that crap there before it was redone.
Okay, final answer?
Yeah, final answer.
You're absolutely correct. The World of Color debuted. It was a spectacular display of water and special effects. It features more than 1,000 jets of water, which form incredible shapes and time to music, allowing Disney characters to come to life on a shimmering veil of mist. Also officially debuting, Silly Symphony Swings, a wave swinger attraction in Paradise Pier. This is themed to Walt Disney's The Band Concert. Features conductor Mickey Mouse conducting the attraction from high atop. Although technically The Band Concert is not a part of the Silly Symphonies film series, the name has been applied to the attraction due to its symphony storyline. So we are already at a tie, 2-2. Very good. Okay. Luella, back to you.
Okay.
Disney's animated feature film Mulan premiered in this city on June 12th, 1998.
Ooh, premiered. Okay. I'm going to have to ask for multiple choice.
All right. Is it A, New York City, B, Los Angeles, C, Singapore, or D, Shanghai?
Well, June 12, 1998, I'm not going to say Shanghai because I don't think it would have premiered there just yet. And Singapore, I'm going back and forth between LA and Singapore. You know, I'm going to take a chance and say Singapore. I'm going to go see Singapore with my final answer.
All right. You are correct.
Woohoo!
The answer is C. Disney's animated feature Mulan premieres in Singapore based on the Chinese legend of Hua Mulan. I'm sure I got her first name in wrong. Mulan is the first of what will be three features produced primarily at the Disney Animation Studio at Disney MGM Studios. The film will be released in the United States 7 days later. So Yay. Very good. I remember seeing them working on that when we were at the Disney MGM Studios.
So. Nice. Okay. I do love that movie.
I do too. Not the sequel. which they showed us, and we were being driven, I think, to the Great Wall of China.
Oh, did
it? Oh, wonderful.
It was horrible. I think I fell asleep. All right. Okay. So excellent. So 4 points. Okay. 4-2 so far. Okay. Craig, over to you. This event provides some unexpected excitement to the star-studded red carpet opening of the new Cars Land at Disney California Adventure on June 13th, 2012.
I am pretty sure I know the answer to this, because I know people who were at the red carpet, but I'm not positive, so I want to hear multiple choice.
Right. Was it A, the surprise early debut of the Mad Tea Party as part of the festivities, B, a 4.1 earthquake that shakes parts of Southern California, C, a demonstration by local service unions representing Disneyland Resort housekeeping employees currently in a contract dispute with Disney, D, a power failure shutting down sections of Disney California Adventure but not affecting Cars Land?
I believe, unless I was lied to, I believe there was an earthquake.
And you believe correctly. A 4.1 earthquake in Yorba Linda that shakes parts of Southern California on this evening adds a little extra unexpected excitement to the red carpet opening of the new Cars Land. Some of the actors and singers behind the scenes of Cars and stars of the ABC Network and Disney Channel walk the red carpet for the premiere party for Cars Land at Disney California Adventure. A 2.4 magnitude aftershock is reported a few minutes after the main quake. The new area will open to the public Friday, June 15th.
I could have guessed that one.
Of course, Luella and I can tell you a 4.1. I mean, if you drop a book on the floor, it's a 4.1 earthquake.
Yeah, I mean I can't remember the earthquakes because they just come and go. it's just a part of life here.
That's like nothing. I mean, yeah.
I remember being told for that one that they were told about it, but didn't really recognize it at the time. No. So I still haven't been through one yet. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, and a 2.4, we have those every day. I mean, in California, it's not a big deal. But anyway, but if you're visiting from elsewhere, it is. Yeah. We have been in Disneyland for major quakes, so that's a little different. Okay, excellent, very good. We're tied again.
Eek. All right.
Okay. Wow, I'm really impressed. You're both on your games here. Okay, all right, Luella, back to you for June 14th.
Yes.
Walt Disney leads a planning meeting at Wed Imagineering on June 14, 1965. The meeting allows Walt Disney to present his ideas about the Florida property to the board members and legal staff of Walt Disney Productions, lawyers and consultants from the state of Florida, and Disney's legal staff from New York City. What name is given to this project as part of this meeting?
Let's get a multiple choice.
Okay. Is it A, the Florida Project, B, Project X, C, Disneyland 2.0, or D, Project Future?
You know, I'm just, I, I'm really not quite sure, but all I keep hearing is Florida Project. So I'm going to say A, the Florida Project.
Okay, final answer.
Final answer.
That is incorrect.
Eek! Ugh, okay.
Oh, gosh, your first one, but you're still doing well here. Okay, Craig, over to you. What name is given to the project as part of this meeting at Wet Imagineering on June 14th, 1965? Was it the Project X, Disneyland 2.0, or Project Future?
I honestly don't know this one. The only thing I could think of is that I don't feel like Walt would say the words Disneyland 2.0. That doesn't feel like something from that generation. That feels like something you either made up or something that is more of our generation right now at this point. So I'll go with Project X. I know that sounds weird, but that's what I would name something if I didn't quite know what it would be named yet.
Okay, final answer?
Yeah.
It was Project X in the early stages when they were purchasing the land, but planning meeting for Project Future takes place at WED Enterprises. Mm. So after the meeting, Walt's staff will have a better idea of the project's scope and needs so they can begin researching and preparing the necessary legal groundwork.
Huh?
So, and yes, you're right. Walt would never have called it Disneyland 2.0 because a theme park was not part of his vision.
Yeah.
So,
anyway. Hey, I didn't even think about it from that aspect. Mm-hmm. Just that it sounded goofy.
Yeah. Although I think later on they did refer to the Magic Kingdom as Disneyland 2.0 as they started to build it.
Buff.
So anyway, just unofficially amongst themselves. Well, it's still a tie score. And now, Craig, it's your turn. So you can pull ahead here. Right. On June 15th, 1944, the Disney Studio Labor Management Commission newsletter prints an article which states Ward Kimball's Huggajiti-8 is doing a well job of entertaining the boys in the hospitals. What is this in reference to? Huggajiti-8. Is doing a well job of entertaining the boys in the hospitals.
I will. I have to go multiple choice.
Okay. Is it A, one of the Walt Disney Studio World War II short propaganda films animated and directed by Ward Kimball? B, Ward Kimball's musical group, which will eventually become the Firehouse 5 Plus 2? C, a traveling art collection of well-known works of art revised by Ward, such as Mona Lisa with her hair up in curlers, or Whistler's mother watching television. D, a jazz instrumental piece written by Ward Kimball. The musical piece would be featured in the film Hit Parade of 1951.
I have a feeling on what it is, but I want to get rid of one just in case.
All right. Let's get rid of D, a jazz instrumental piece written by Ward Kimball.
Okay. I have my gut instinct is going towards the Firehouse 5. And the only reason why I'm going there is because Firehouse 5 Plus 2 and the Huggajiti-8, those are very similar to each other. So I'm assuming that maybe one person just left at some point, and that's how it went from 8 to 5 Plus 2. And that's basically the only basis I'm giving for it, because it could easily be the other two, but I'm going with that. Mm-hmm. Which I believe was A, maybe?
B.
B? So, okay.
Yep, Disney Studio Labor Management Commission newsletter notes Ward Kimball's Huggajiti-8 is doing a swell job of entertaining the boys in the hospitals. Next trip will be to Norconia TB Ward, where they'll try a new act complete with Chalk Talk Skits and Jam Session. This is in reference to Kimball's musical group, which will eventually turn into the Firehouse 5 Plus 2. Very good. You got one point for that.
Wow, that's excellent.
So yeah. did they just lose a member? Is that...
I have no idea. It sounds like it. But Ward was just so odd with everything, which he, you know, reveled in.
Yeah.
So who knows? But anyway, so very good. Okay, it's 5-4. Craig, you, for the first time, you've pulled ahead here. But Luella, you have the last question.
Okay,
so
okay.
You could win it all here. Okay, so this is for June 16th. On June 16th, 1961, Walt Disney purchased the film rights to this book series.
I feel like I know it, but let's go with multiple choice.
Is it A, the Tarzan series by Edgar Rice Burroughs? B, the Wizard of Oz series with the exception of the first book? C, Winnie the Pooh series by A.A. Milne? Or D, the Mary Poppins series by P.L. Travers?
Okay. I'm going to go with D, the Mary Poppins series by P.L. Travers.
Okay, is that your final answer?
That's my final answer.
Okay, that is incorrect.
Ah!
He had actually
That's what
bought
I was hoping.
It like 20 years prior to
That's right. It was 20 years prior, but it took a while to make the movie.
It did. It did.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Craig, here you go. All right. So, Craig, on June 16th, 1961, which book series did Walt Disney purchase the film rights for? Was it the Tarzan series, the Wizard of Oz series, except for the first book, or the Winnie the Pooh series?
I might be wrong, but kind of based on that same logic, I know there was different circumstances, but I know, I mean, maybe they didn't have the rights to Wizard of Oz, but I remember the Return to Oz movie, and I feel like they would have needed some rights to do that. Whereas I believe by the time they got around to making Tarzan, they didn't need the rights anymore at that point, because it would have been public domain. But that could have been the same for Wizard of Oz, but... And I feel... I mean, I guess it could be Winnie the Pooh. They turned that into it, too, but... My gut instinct was Wizard of Oz, so I'm going to go with that.
Okay, he had actually purchased those rights earlier as well.
And they
made Return to Oz before they lost the rights. But yeah, in fact, there is a Mickey Mouse Club episode where Walt talks about the film he's going to make, and the Mouseketeers act out a little musical number based on The Wizard of Oz, the next series. Yeah. It's actually Walt Disney purchases the film rights to the Winnie the Pooh stories from Mrs. Daphne Milne, wife of the late author A.A. Milne. The first film, Winnie the Pooh and the Honey Tree, will appear in 1966 as a 26-minute short.
Huh.
So, well, Craig, congratulations. You squeaked by here 5-4.
Barely.
So,
it seems.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo. Very good.
You got rough there at the end.
Well, Luella, you did a great job, though.
Oh, I can't believe I got the Mary Poppins one wrong. I've seen the movie. I love Mary Poppins, but now that it's coming back to me, that's right. It took a while to make those movies.
It did. It did. He persevered with those. But because he discovered the stories from his daughter, Diane,
yes,
who had it at the side of her bed. And
yes,
on her nightstand, and she showed it to him, and he took a look at it. So, yeah. So anyway, well, great. Well, Luella, we have to have you back next week.
Yes,
you did
definitely.
Such a great job.
I need to redeem myself.
Excellent. Well, there wasn't much to redeem here. You did a really good job. But we will look forward to having you next week on Connecting with Walt.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Well, you know, that was what a great conversation we had with Jeff. I've been wanting to have him on the show for such a long time. And it was just fascinating to hear those stories about Walt and a little more depth about Walt and how his travels were such an influence on him, and how he was an influence on his travels.
Oh, absolutely. Also. Yeah, no, yeah. This happens a lot of times when you and I do the interviews, is that we both obviously have a chance to speak up and really jump in on it. I just get so fascinated with where the conversation goes. A lot of times I just have to sit back and listen to it as if I am a regular listener with it. And, you know, it happened when we did our interview with Marcy on Eat Like mm-hmm. Walt. It happened with this. All the way back the last time when we had Bob Gurr on the show. It's just, I congratulate you on finding the right people to bring on with this. So I have purchased many of Jeff's books too, just like you have, and they're treasures in my library. So to get to hear him discuss this tonight was just a real big treat.
It was so fascinating too, because it was almost like he had some of my notes, because I had a lot of questions about his creative process for the book. Yeah. Because it's as he said, it is so different from a traditional Disney history book, not just because of its theme, where he's exploring Walt through the eyes of Walt's travel, but also just it's not linear. And I just found that really interesting. And to hear his creative process as he walked through, you know, the inception of the book and then how it developed and grew, and his whole process for putting it together and gathering the photographs and the design of the book and everything. I just was fascinated by all of that. So
yeah.
So I think as we begin, as I mentioned, as we begin the travel season, whether you are traveling from your armchair or traveling on Disney Cruise Line, or traveling around the world, this is definitely a book that I think you would enjoy taking with you and relaxing with. Travels with Walt Disney, A Photographic Voyage Around the World.
Absolutely.
So, Craig, until next time, where can our listeners connect with you on the Diz Unplugged?
Like always, you can find me Tuesdays on the Walt Disney World Edition podcast, on Thursdays on the Universal Edition podcast, Wednesdays on the Best and Worst of Walt Disney World podcast, either Thursdays or Fridays on the Diz Daily Fix, and then I will break the barrier that we are always hiding behind, but we're actually getting ready to record the first renditions of the new Disneyland show tomorrow, and of course I'll be behind the technical aspects of it, and knowing how things happen in this company, I'll probably end up on it too, so I'll just throw a shameless plug out for that yeah, might hear me chime in a time or two, because it probably will happen. But then, as always, the fun places where you can connect with me, not that our shows aren't fun, but where I'll actually interact right back in real time with you on Twitter and Instagram at Teleclaster. But Michael, what about you?
Well, you can send me messages at michael@wdwinfo.com, Twitter at mbowling121, Facebook, I'm Michael Bowling with the Connecting with Walt banner, and Instagram, Michael Bowling the Diz. And you can connect with me and Craig on Connecting with Walt on Twitter at Connecting Walt. And I wanted to follow up on an announcement we made last week. Craig, listeners are going to be a part of our show very soon.
Yeah.
And that you're going to be putting something out there about submitting questions for our spring Q&A episode.
Exactly. Yeah, so it is going to be coming on Facebook, so I thought it would already be out there, except I didn't even talk to Michael about this, but we've been recently merging our Disneyland Facebook page with our Diz Disneyland Edition podcast Facebook page with the Disney World one. So while we're in that transition, it's kind of been a little bit rocky on things that are posting besides the normal things, but it will be out there. Those questions, they'll be able to be asked very shortly. And as we've done in the past too, of course, as always, it's just not show topics once it's out there and open and available. Just actual full-blown questions, and like we've mentioned, please keep it all in that one Facebook post, not in separate emails, not separate posts on the boards, not on Twitter, just on that one Facebook message that does go out there.
Excellent. Yeah, so keep an eye out for that. Yeah. So, and if you would like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studio, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes at DisUnplugged.com, and look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings. And thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother Roy.